The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. I'd like to welcome to the program today Susan Orlean. She joins us on the telephone in Southern California. Hello, Susan.
So nice to be with you.
I'm just assuming you're in Southern California.
I am.
Oh, good.
I am.
All right. Well, I've wanted to interview you since you wrote about Ren 10 10. I could not get an interview with you for that book, and I am crazy about this new book, so I'm so happy to be able to talk to you about it. It's called The Library Book, and it's a fascinating story to me because I discovered when I got to page 92, I believe, that you were done. You were not going to be writing any more books. You were finished, and then suddenly I think you took your son to the library and something happened.
I was not done being a writer. I should make that clear. But I really didn't feel that I had the stamina to take on another huge project. My books have all taken me a long time. I'm not very fast, and I tend to report them pretty thoroughly. And I just thought, I don't think I want to do another book. And it was very much a matter of having this really emotional experience when I took my son to the library and finding myself fascinated by the power of being in a library and how much it moved me, that it made me begin wondering what there was to explore about the subject, and it kind of grew from there.
It also reminded you of your childhood and going to the library with your mom.
Very much. This was almost it was a powerful trip through memories that I hadn't really explored in a long time, and it was very, very emotional and very meaningful in a way that I had never contemplated. So it was a way of sort of reconnecting with some memories of my mom, particularly at a moment when, as I would learn soon into working on the book, when my mom's memory itself was beginning to deteriorate. So kind of retrieving those memories became very important to me.
And it's very powerful the way you describe it on that page, because you talk about how the two of you had these shared memories of going to the library and running off in your different directions and getting your piles of books. And you ponder the thought that if a memory is no longer shared, if your mother's cognitive issues make it so that she doesn't really remember it anymore, what kind of a memory is that?
It was a very profound and quite sobering thing to consider, which was the realization that so many memories are transactional. You know, it's a memory shared by people. And in this case, it was these trips that we took together, and that was a very important aspect of the trip, was going there together and the sort of rituals of our visits to the library that were really important to us. As my mom began losing her memory, it became, I felt, a sort of obligation and desire on my part to commit those memories to some permanent form and to put them down on paper and to save them the way that I began to realize that no individual could ever save them, that eventually it would be hard for me to remember those trips as well. And that's part of the magic of books and of libraries, is that they can preserve a memory forever, theoretically, whereas an individual, you know, we're all limited by the scope of our memory and ultimately the sort of scope of our life. But a book can live on and on, which is what makes them so extraordinary.
And maybe, just maybe, some of us, if we write a book, will be remembered.
Well, that was certainly powerful for me. And I realized that from the time I was a kid, I think part of my attraction to the idea of being a writer was the idea that you were going to be preserving some story or some aspect of yourself forever.
Mm.
And that was very attractive to me as a prospect. So it was certainly a part of what drew me to being a writer, for sure.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to 91.3 WYSO, Building a More Informed Community with Independent News and Storytelling. My guest on the program today is Susan Orlean, and her new book, The Library Book, just came out in paperback. How did you decide to focus on the Los Angeles Public Library, and in particular, this tragic fire? How did you come up with this?
I had just moved to Los Angeles, so it was very natural that as I began thinking about writing about libraries, that this would be the obvious one to write about, since it was my hometown library. But it had a fascinating history, which many libraries do have fascinating histories. It had a particularly interesting history. But then in addition, when I heard about this disastrous fire, which was the largest library fire in American history, that to me seemed like a story that needed to be told. And I was fascinated by the fact that I had never heard anything about, you know, this was a major event in the world of books and the world of libraries. And it was really interesting to me that I had somehow never heard of it and never knew anything about it and really knew nothing about the phenomenon of burned libraries, which unfortunately, as I discovered, is something that has occurred far more often than we'd like to think. It's definitely a fact of library life that, you know, has persisted since the very first libraries were built. Libraries are places that are vulnerable to fire for obvious reasons, but they've also been targeted for the very reason that they're so important to us, which is that they contain all the knowledge and they are as close a reflection of a society as anything. And so when a society is being threatened by an oppressive regime or an autocrat of some sort, libraries are the first thing to go.
We learn in your book how this structure came to be. You take us through the history, and I enjoy the way that you keep circling back to the fire, and then you take us through the chronology of the library system and all these amazing people that have been involved with it over the years and have made it the system that it became. And then we learn about this building and how it came to be, and what a beautiful building it was, but also what a perfect combustible fire trap it was. And the fire was, if you could call a fire perfect, it was a perfect fire, the way it burned. You described it burned almost without a visible flame at some points, didn't it?
It was, it really was essentially the perfect storm of fires. It rose to temperatures of 2,500 degrees, if you can imagine. it was so hot that it wasn't just that the books were burning. It was that the steel shelving melted. It was an incineration. And at the end of the 7.5 hours that the fire raged, 400,000 books were completely destroyed and 700,000 were badly damaged. So this was, by all accounts, as close to a perfect inferno as you could get. And a lot of the firefighters I interviewed who have seen many, many fires, and they're probably a little bit jaded by some of what they see, since this is what they do all the time. But they were awed by this. Mm-hmm. They were stunned by the intensity of the fire and the fact that it burned the way that it burned.
You're listening to the Book Nook. We'll be right back. My guest is Susan Orlean. It's the Book Nook, and we're talking about the library book. And this program is underwritten by 5 library systems in our region. And I can't think of a more perfect library book than this one. This is amazing. What a wonderful thing to be able to talk about this with you, Susan. And the books you just mentioned that were damaged, what a miraculous thing. You describe what lengths they went to try to salvage some of these books, and that was truly weird and unbelievable in a way.
It was unbelievable. And, you know, a few people have said to me, why did they go to so much trouble to save the books? Why didn't they just replace them? Well, when you have 700,000 books that have been damaged, many of them are going to be books that are not easily replaced. And that was certainly the case for the majority of these books. They were, you don't just go to Amazon and click on the buy button when you're talking about 700,000 books that have been collected over decades and decades. So, you know, that it wasn't a simple matter of just going and replacing a book. It was replacing an entire collection that wasn't easily replaced. So there was a great hope that these damaged books, most of which were wet from the water used to put out the fire, there was a hope that they could be salvaged. But that in itself is not easily done. It was the largest book restoration project ever undertaken, you know, 700,000 wet books. So they had to be in some fashion held in limbo while the money and the resources were assembled to try to dry them out. And, you know, some amount of science had to be figured out, like how do you dry 700,000 books? If you have a wet book, it will mold within 48 hours. And if a book molds, then it can't be saved. Mm-hmm. It's really hopeless. If it's wet and you freeze it, you still have the hope that you can thaw it out and dry it eventually. And the happy ending of this story is that a remarkable percentage of these damaged books were actually salvaged. They were, through great effort and a lot of smart people putting their heads together, there were systems devised to dry these books, to squeeze out the gallons and gallons of water, and then dry the pages so that they were flat and rebind books that needed to be rebound or put new covers on and so forth. And the vast majority of them were salvaged. And if you go to the LA Library today, many of those books are still on the shelves. They were saved, they were dried, they were put back into the catalog, and they sit on the shelves today.
You talk about walking through the library and the librarian pulling a book off the shelf and opening it up and taking a whiff of it and saying, yep, this is one. This one got smoke on it. You could still smell it a little bit.
Yeah, and that was really where the first time I ever heard anything about the fire was when this head of the Library Foundation was sniffing a book, and I didn't quite understand what he meant when he said you can still smell the fire.
Mm.
So I sort of quizzed him about it, and he said, well, you know, from the fire. And I said, well, I don't know what you mean, from mm-hmm. what fire? And he said, well, the big fire in 1986, he was astonished that I had never heard of it. Well, I wasn't living in L.A. at the time. But even so, I think for the people who lived through it, it was such an epic event that it dominated their lives for years as the library was restored. It was closed for 7 years. It was one of those moments where I thought,
mm-hmm.
what is this about? And boy, that would make an interesting book.
Well, it certainly does. My guest is Susan Orlean. Her book is The Library Book. And it should be noted that, no, you couldn't go on Amazon and order yourself a new Shakespeare folio. They had quite a collection of all kinds of irreplaceable things in the library. And you go off on all these different tangents. I love the one about the maps and this gifted individual, this young man who found the map of the Olympics inside another map and where those maps came from and just all these strange little avenues that you take us down. And one of the strangest ones is the guy who might have been the arsonist. You spend a lot of time on him. What an interesting and weird guy.
Yes, and he was a fascinating person to write about because on one hand, he was somebody who was the one and only suspect in this fire, and certainly I think most of us would react very strongly to the idea of somebody callously setting a library on fire. On the other hand, there was something about Harry Peake that made people really like him. He was a somewhat guileless, likable, charming, charismatic young man who nobody spoke ill of. Everybody found him frustrating because he was the kind of guy who wouldn't pay his rent on time and would lose the keys to your car and was always just sort of out of step with what life required. But there was nothing about him that seemed aggressive or mean or destructive. So this was a very strange thing for him to be caught up in. And I followed his story because it was also in many ways the sort of quintessential LA story of somebody who is dazzled by the idea of fame and celebrity, comes to LA seeking those things, but instead is doing menial jobs and barely scraping by. And that's very much the personality of the city, that there are a lot of people who are just drawn here because of the promise of success.
Well, it's truly bizarre how his version of events kept changing from a handsome fireman carried me out of the building. And he just, he's a serial liar. And the whole pathological.
that was the thing that I found so almost disarming about him is that his clumsiness as a liar and the fact that he came up with 7 different alibis, which, I think anyone who even watches Law and Order would tell you that that's not a very persuasive thing. Mm. If you're trying to convince someone that you didn't do a crime, you would generally sort of pick one story and stick to it. And he just kept changing his story wildly, not even variations on a similar story, just completely different stories.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, you began to feel, or I began to feel, that I'm not even sure he had any idea of what the truth was. He had embroidered so richly on the reality of what went on that day that I honestly think if you said to him, seriously, between you and me, what happened, I'm not even sure he would have even known anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a, and he fibbed constantly. This was something that all his friends said about him, his family said about him. And so it's very hard when you're kind of dealing with somebody who fibs all the time. It's really hard to tell when their fib is actually the truth. You know, when it was impossible to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not honestly not sure that he ever really had a sense of what went on that day because he had lied about it so much.
Most of us have met someone like that. Pathological liar, doesn't pay their bills. Sounds really familiar, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, he is certainly a type. And I think he had, in addition, a quality of likability that made people forgive him time and time again, even though I think it was pretty well understood by the people who knew him that you couldn't believe a word he said.
My guest is Susan Orlean. We're talking about her book, The Library Book, which just came out in paperback and was a bestseller in hardcover, and I can certainly understand why. And it's such a fascinating history. We learn about all these visionary leaders of this library system over the years, and many of them were women. And the ones that aren't interesting, you really just don't bother to cover. But the ones that are interesting, whoa. I think this Charles Loomis guy is one of the most amazing people I've ever imagined existed. What a strange man.
Totally fascinating. And nothing he did was ordinary. He was the head of the library for 5 years around the turn of the century. He was a true eccentric, also a real visionary, really a genius in many ways, a man who had a lot of attitudes that were very modern compared to the moment of time that he lived in. For instance, he believed libraries should be accessible to everybody and not simply places for the rich and educated. And we're all very used to that idea at this point, but in the 1900s, in the early part of the century, that wasn't a commonly held idea. Women were not allowed to use the full resources of the library. Children were not allowed in the library. They were, and I'm talking about public libraries, but the definition of who constituted the public was very different in 1905. And Charles Loomis thought that was nonsense. One of the first things he did as the head of the LA Library was insist on opening the doors to everybody. And he approached factories and railroad companies and working class unions and said, send your members to the library. It will be, it's a place for people to learn and educate themselves and improve themselves. They should be using the library. And up until that point, that was not really the message that libraries sent out. So but his eccentricity was extraordinary. And I really loved writing about him because he was somebody who, if there was a weird way to do something, he did it that way.
Yeah.
Wow. He just couldn't do anything by the book, no pun intended. But, for instance, he had been working as a journalist in Cincinnati as a young man. He was offered a job at the L.A. Times, and this was 1898, I believe. So he packed up his belongings in Cincinnati and walked to Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
And now this would be an accomplishment today. You can imagine in 1898, that would have been an even greater accomplishment and one that very few people undertook. Mm. So, you know, just as an example of his way of looking at the world, you just didn't do things the ordinary way.
One of the themes that really comes through in your book is that libraries, public libraries, are places of sanctuary, and they've become very much places of sanctuary for the homeless. And you talk a lot about this. You talk about the homeless who spend a lot of time in the main library in Los Angeles, and you walked around with some of the security guards, and you learned so much about the situation.
That was absolutely fascinating and valuable, in my opinion, because this is a reality of the entire, not only the American landscape, but frankly the global landscape, which is we have a global crisis of homelessness, and the number of places where people who don't have a home can spend time safely are few and far between. And libraries are prominent among those as places where if you are homeless, you may find a safe, warm place to spend some time, as well as access to a computer, as well as access to books and librarians who might direct you to things that you're trying to learn. So they're wonderful places for people who have very little. It presents a challenge on a lot of levels, which is there are a large percentage of homeless people who have additional issues, drug problems, mental health problems. So libraries are suddenly grappling with the challenge of serving this very diverse public. And many people don't encounter homeless people or disadvantaged people in their regular daily life. That it's just not, there aren't that many places where you're going to share space with somebody who's homeless. So there is a chafing and a kind of adjustment for both populations to share this space together. Similarly, libraries have to have the challenge of the resources that they do and don't have to use for people who need additional services. Mm-hmm. And we as a culture have kind of passively let libraries step into that role of being this resource for homelessness. And we haven't really followed up with additional funding or training or any of the things that would make sense to provide. So I have to say I have a huge admiration for what libraries have done under circumstances that are very challenging and where we've asked them to do much more than what their charter requires. And they've done it not only uncomplainingly, but with a tremendous amount of effort and devotion. And, you know, I'd like to see society dealing with the issue of homelessness urgently, because I think it's an absolute crisis. And I'd also like to see us try to support libraries in those additional ways, as they have stepped up to do additional work that is absolutely needed by all of us.
Well, Susan, I love libraries. I'm very fond of librarians, and I absolutely enjoyed your book, The Library Book. Thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Well, it's my pleasure. I really appreciate it so much.
What a pleasure it was to have Susan Orlean on the program. We have a little extra time left this morning, and I want to read you a little excerpt from her book, one that really struck me. I mentioned it during the interview. This is from The Library Book by Susan Orlean. She writes, "Right before learning about the library fire, I had decided I was done with writing books. Working on them felt like a slow-motion wrestling match. And I wasn't in the mood to grapple with such a big commitment again, but here I was. I knew part of what hooked me had been the shock of familiarity I felt when I took my son to our local library, the way it telegraphed my childhood, my relationship to my parents, my love of books. It brought me close in my musings to my mother and to our sojourns to the library. It was wonderful and it was bittersweet. Because just as I was rediscovering those memories, my mother was losing all of hers. When I first told her that I was writing a book about libraries, she was delighted. And she said she was proud that she had a part in making me find them wondrous. But soon, the dark fingers of dementia got her in their grip, and they pried loose random bits of her memory every day. The next time I reminded her about the project and told her how much I had been thinking about our trips to Bertram Woods Library, she smiled with encouragement, but with no apparent recognition of what I meant. Each time I visited, she receded a little bit more. She became vague, absent, isolated in her thoughts, or maybe in some pillowy blankness that filled in where the memories had been chipped away. And I knew that now I was carrying the remembrance for both of us. My mother imbued me with a love of libraries. The reason why I finally embraced this book project, wanted and then needed to write it, was my realization that I was losing her. I found myself wondering whether a shared memory can exist if one of the people sharing it no longer remembers it. Is the circuit broken? The memory darkened? My mother was the one person, besides me, who knew what those gauzy afternoons had been like. I knew I was writing this because I was trying hard to preserve those afternoons. I convinced myself that committing them to a page meant the memory was saved somehow from the corrosive effect of time. The idea of being forgotten is terrifying. I fear not just that I personally will be forgotten, but that we are all doomed to being forgotten, that the sum of life is ultimately nothing, that we experience joy and disappointment and aches and delights and loss, make our little mark on the world, and then we vanish. And the mark is erased, and it is as if we never existed. If you gaze into that bleakness even for a moment, the sum of life becomes null and void, because if nothing lasts, nothing matters. It means that everything we experience unfolds without a pattern, and life is just a wild, random, baffling occurrence, a scattering of notes with no melody. But if something you learn or observe or imagine can be set down and saved, and if you can see your life reflected in previous lives and can imagine it reflected in subsequent ones, you can begin to discover order and harmony. You know that you are part of a larger story that has shape and purpose, a tangible, familiar past, and a constantly refreshed future. We are all whispering in a tin can on a string, but we are heard. So we whisper the message into the next tin can and the next string. Writing a book, just like building a library, is an act of sheer defiance. It is a declaration that you believe in the persistence of memory. In Senegal, the polite expression for saying someone died is to say his or her library has burned. When I first heard the phrase, I didn't understand it. But over time, I came to realize it was perfect. Our minds and souls contain volumes inscribed by our experiences and emotions. Each individual's consciousness is a collection of memories we've cataloged and stored inside us, a private library of a life lived. It is something that no one else can entirely share, one that burns down and disappears when we die. But if you can take something from that internal collection and share it with one person or with the larger world, on the page or in a story recited, it takes on a life of its own. Susan Orlean from the Library Book. I have a special Best of the Book Nook bonus coming your way. Don't go away. Right after this. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. If you've been listening to the station for a while, you might recall that between 1993 and 2003, I was the host of thousands of music programs here on the station. From 1994 to 2003, every weekday afternoon, I hosted afternoon excursions, and the final hour of the program at 2 o'clock each day was the Book Nook. And during that period, I interviewed a lot of musicians, and a lot of musicians with connections to our licensee at the time, Antioch College. And one of them I interviewed was a guy named John Hammond. Let's listen now to my interview from 2003 with John Hammond. Going back for that one, Graham Parsons, going back about 30 years. And we're going to go back even further now here on WYSO. We're going to go back about 40 years to a voice you might have heard on these airwaves once upon a time. I'd like to welcome to the program John Hammond. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I'm very happy to be on the show.
John, you went to Antioch College, didn't you?
1960-61.
What was it like back in those days?
It was wonderful. It was exciting. And I had my own blues show on WYSO, The Sound of the Blues, with John Hammond and Bob Silverman.
Wow. What, do you remember what day or night that was?
Oh, golly. That's pushing it.
Well, we had Jorma Kalkinen on the program last week.
And oh, that's great.
He mentioned you guys overlapped by about a year. You're, what, about a year younger than he is?
I am a year younger, but I was here on campus with him for a year and a half before I left to pursue my career.
And you've really been pursuing it. How many albums is it now?
Well, I think this is the 29th album that I've made.
And it's Ready for Love.
Ready for Love, yes.
It just came out, and this one is special because there's a song on here that is unlike any other song you've ever recorded, right?
Well, there's one that I wrote.
Have you ever recorded one of your own songs before?
I did on my first record.
Did you?
It was so awful I didn't want to record it, but they said, oh, it would be good.
Oh.
But anyway, this is the first one that I've written in 42 years. So
first one that you claim?
Yes.
And that's Slick Crown Vic.
Yeah.
Is that the model of car that you're sitting on the bumper of?
That's right.
Okay. That looks like
it was the first car that I bought in 1962 in Los Angeles. It was a Crown Vic Ford 1955, and I drove it all over the U.S. and Canada.
Is that the same car?
It isn't the exact same car, no.
No, I was going to say, that car is probably long gone.
Oh, I got broke and sold it.
How'd you get into this music thing? I understand your family might have had something to do with it, but I'm also going to guess maybe some people that you knew at Antioch. Like, was there a guy named Ian that you knew?
Well, yes. You know, when I came to Antioch, I was not a guitar player, but I was a blues fanatic. Since I was about 14 or so, I'd gotten sucked into the blues tradition, the history, the incredible depth. So when I came to Antioch, I was knew all these great songs and had some good records, thus the radio show. But there were guys on campus who were really good players. One was Ian Buchanan, who was as I remember, a psych major, and older than me by 3 years or so. But he could really play, and he could play Blind Boy Fuller stuff and Gary Davis. He was a great guitar player, but he could also sing, too. And I thought he was really cool, as did Jorma Kaukonen, who was there. And I used to watch those guys play, and I was inspired. I watched my friend Bob Silverman play, who was also a really good guitar player.
Uh-huh.
And my roommate at that time was a guy named Russell Avery, and he also played. He had a Martin 12-string guitar. It was just awesome.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, I was surrounded by these guys. I said, I better get my act together. So I bought a guitar for $10 from Carlotta Jones and proceeded to teach myself to play.
Was Carlotta Jones one of your fellow students?
Yes. She was not really a great guitar player, but she had a great guitar.
Ah.
And I mean, in hindsight, it wasn't so great a guitar, but I thought it was wonderful.
For $10, eh?
$10,
yeah. Get you started. John Hammond joins us. He has a new album out. It's called Ready for Love, and we've got him back on the WISO airwaves after about a, well, 40-some year absence, at least his voice, but you've been hearing plenty of his music on the station.
Oh, wow.
You played a special concert here, what's it been, a year and a half, 2 years ago?
That's right, with Guy Davis.
That was great.
Oh, that was wonderful. It was a real thrill to be back on the campus and to, you know, get that pang.
Uh-huh. A couple of years ago, I interviewed another musician who's kind of got a thing for the blues, and during our interview, your name came up. I was talking to Bill Wyman.
Oh, wow. Well, he was a friend at a time when everybody was just getting started, you know, and he was just a terrific guy, played great bass, was a blues fanatic, and I got to know him and Brian Jones real well. And, yeah.
He said you guys had some fun together.
Oh, we certainly did. We made a record together, too.
Is that album still around?
Yes, it is. It's, I Can Tell. And it was released on Atlantic in 1967.
Wow. Well, he said you guys used to like to go out and see music together.
We did, and I hope he's doing great because he's just a fantastic guy.
Well, I had a guy on yesterday, a Scottish mystery writer named Ian Rankin, who said he just had a meal with Bill the other day in Edinburgh, and he said he's doing well.
Oh, that's fantastic.
My guest is John Hammond, and John, a year or so ago, you put out an album covering music of Tom Waits, and I'm telling you what, people were knocked out by this album. How did you get the notion to do that?
Well, I've known Tom for about 26 years. We used to hang out and play some gigs together. He lived for a while in New York area, in New York, and so we hung out a bit there. Then he moved to back out to the West Coast, and I sort of lost touch with him for a while, and 1992, he gave me a song to record. And then in 1998, this is to make a long story very short, he asked me to play on his Mule Variations album.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, my wife Marla and his wife Kathleen got together, were hanging out, and my wife said, what do you think of the idea of Tom producing an album on John? He could be home every night, take care of the kids. And all of a sudden, it was in our laps. And we had no idea what we were going to do. And I said, well, Tom, do you have a song of yours that you think I might be able to do? And so one led to another, and we recorded 20 Tom Waits songs and a traditional gospel tune. And out came in 5 days this record, and it's just been a real thrill for me. It was great to work with Tom. He was a fantastic inspiration to play. He played in the band doing his songs my way.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it was really thrilling, honestly. It was one of those, you got to pinch yourself and say, is this my life?
Yeah.
You know, it was extraordinary. And I put a band together to tour, to promote the record, and the band congealed as a unit. We became, you know, a real band. And we were looking forward to our next project and to record together again after a year and a half on the road doing, you know, the Tom Waits tunes.
Uh-huh.
And so we went into the studio in the end of this past September, and in 5 days we made Ready for Love. And
so there
it was produced by David Hidalgo from Los Lobos,
mm-hmm.
who was also inspirational and played on just about every track. With Augie Myers on keyboards and accordion, Stephen Hodges on drums and percussion, Frank Carrillo on guitar, and Marty Ballou on bass.
And I see you played a couple of David's tunes on here.
Yes, we did.
Yeah.
And we also had Susie Tyrell, a fiddle player, a singer, songwriter in her own right, who's now playing with Bruce Springsteen.
Huh.
And so she sat in for the three country tunes we did and played some just outrageous fiddle.
Really?
And vocal harmonies on those three.
It's a tasty album, John. And,
oh, well, thank you.
We're really appreciative of the fact that you had a moment to talk to us here in your old stomping grounds.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I mean, really. And I've heard, you know, when I travel through Ohio and through Indiana, I mean, I get it on the radio.
Oh, yeah.
So I've been in touch.
Hey, well, next time you're in the area, stop by.
I definitely will.
John, we're going to play that song you wrote, Slick Crown Vic, and we really thank you for reconnecting with us here in Yellow Springs.
Vic, it's a pleasure, man.
This is John Hammond with his new album, Ready for Love, and a song he wrote. It's Slick Crown Vic, and I don't love it just because my name's Vic. And that was John Hammond, recorded 16 years ago, and we're not going to play that song, folks. Sorry about that. But I did play it back in 2003, right after I completed my interview with John Hammond, who is still around, still performing. And I learned before I did that interview that he was somewhat estranged from his father. So I never mentioned his father, who was a very famous person. John Hammond began playing guitar in high school, partially inspired by the album Jimmy Reed at Carnegie Hall. He attended Antioch College for 1 year, but dropped out to pursue a music career. By the mid-1960s, he was touring nationally and living in Greenwich Village. He befriended and recorded with many electric blues musicians in New York, including Jimi Hendrix, Eric Clapton, Levon Helm's New Hawks, later known as The Band, Mike Bloomfield, Dr. John, and Dwayne Allman. His father, John Hammond Sr., who died in 1987, was an American record producer, civil rights activist, and music critic from the 1930s to the early 1980s. In his service as a talent scout, Hammond became one of the most influential figures in 20th century popular music. He was instrumental in sparking or furthering numerous musical careers, including those of Bob Dylan. He signed Bob Dylan to Columbia Records. Also Bruce Springsteen, Benny Goodman, Harry James, Charlie Christian, Billie Holiday, Count Basie, Teddy Wilson, Big Joe Turner, Pete Seeger, Aretha Franklin, George Benson, Freddie Green, Leonard Cohen, Arthur Russell, Asha Puthley, and Stevie Ray Vaughan. He is also largely responsible for the revival of Delta blues artist Robert Johnson's music, and the connection between father and son remains because in 1991, in the United Kingdom, there was a TV documentary called The Search for Robert Johnson, detailing the life of Delta blues man Robert Johnson. And the host of that program was John Hammond Jr. So there's definitely a connection between father and son, even though his parents got divorced when he was very young. And he didn't really know his dad that well, but he knew everybody else, including Jimi Hendrix, of all people. In fact, he's a big buddy of Tom Waits to this very day, as he mentioned during that interview. You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. We started off with The Library Book by Susan Ordlean. Thanks to everyone for tuning in. Let's do it again next week in the Book Nook.